Welcome to the politicalbetting.com polling matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Today we're going to be talking about something different, the upcoming Canadian general election due next Monday, which for those listening later is the 19th of October. If you don't know much about Canadian politics, do not worry. I didn't as of a few days ago, but I've been frantically reading. But fortunately, we were joined by some Canadian experts on the matter today. I'm joined by former Liberal staffer out of the Alberta legislature, Sam Lyon, and Canadian elections expert Adrian McCauley, alongside, as ever, Rob Vance. Welcome all. Before we go into the discussion, I thought, you know, for the listeners' benefits, I thought I'd just give them my little beginner's guide to Canadian politics. And I guess for those who are completely new to it, listeners, I think that the key thing really is it's quite similar to our own system in terms of how you know, members of parliament, or in this case members, I think, are elected. It's a first-past-the-post electoral system, as I say, similar to ours in the UK. Rather than constituencies, though, we have ridings. So you'll hear us referring to ridings during this podcast. That simply means is the equivalent of constituencies. There are currently 308 ridings, but this will rise to 338 at this election. Previously, you needed 155 for a majority, but of course, now you need 170. And we currently have a relatively unpopular Conservative government in power, led by the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. They've been in power since 2006, but they have a majority at the moment, but they're obviously defending that with everything that they've got. The principal opposition is the NPD, and there's an interesting story there where they took over what you might call the traditional leftist party or centrist party, depending on your view, the Liberals, at the previous election. But the NPD are the principal opposition, led by Tom Mulcair, who became leader in 2012 after their former leader, Jack Layton, sadly passed away the previous year. The Liberal Party are led by Justin Trudeau, who is the son of a former Canadian Prime Minister. So it's good to know that the Liberals are not, Labour Party are not the only party in the world that like to have something of a hereditary tradition on the left. So we'll be talking a little bit about that in this podcast. They're looking like they might do very well, and we'll be talking about just how well that might be. And apologies to Canadian listeners for butchering the pronunciation, but we also have the separatists, the Bloc Québécois, and the Greens, and then Strength in Democracy, who have a handful of seats each. So I guess it's a defending Conservative majority government, and guess what? Lyndon Crosby is involved as well. So the election's on Monday, so let's get into it in terms of what's going on. I mean, let's spend the first sort of 10 minutes talking about, you know, what the polls are saying. This is a polling podcast. Adrian, I'll go to you. So I understand this as something of a, or at least it was once upon a time, something of a three-horse race. But what are the current opinion polls saying in terms of what we might see happening on Monday?
Current public opinion polls are really interesting. I would say that there is a broad and general consensus that the Liberals look like the best to form government on October 19th. It's nowhere near a majority territory, but poll after poll, since early October, the Liberals have really started to pick up steam. It was for a large portion of the race, a statistical tie between the three parties, especially in the months of August. It was very, very, it was back and forth between the Liberals and the NDP quite a bit. The NDP entered the once the writ dropped, once the election was official, the NDP polled the highest they've ever polled. They were in the mid to high 35s, almost 40. At one point, there were a couple of polls speculating as to whether the NDP might be able to form a majority government, but that's very much in the past now. The Liberals entered the election campaign, the polling the lowest they've ever polled at around 25%. Now they're polling relatively well. Nanos, which is a very popular public opinion firm in Canada, has a daily tracking poll, and as of today, October 15th, the Liberal Party of Canada, the LPC, was at 37%. The Conservatives were at 29%. And the NDP were at 23 to 24%, depending on how you look at it. So the LPC has a huge lead of about 14 points on the NDP, and let's just say they're well outside the margin of error.
I mean, I'm going to go to Sam in a minute and talk about some of the issues that might be shaping this campaign. But I mean, briefly on the NPD, I mean, what do you think explains that fall away? It seems like they were started off very well, and now they're sort of collapsing.
The NDP story is an interesting one. They entered the campaign when the writ dropped. It was a very uncomfortable point in time for the Conservative government. You may or may not be aware that the Senate is the Canadian Senate is a set of problem, or certainly it was. It's no longer what's for dinner tonight. But a couple months ago, and when the writ dropped, there was former Senator Mike Duffy was on trial. There was a lot of negative publicity surrounding the Senate. Stephen Harper had appointed 57 senators. He wasn't he didn't appoint the most senators. I think Chrétien appointed 70 something. But the Conservative government campaigned back in 2006 and I think 2008 on reforming the Senate. But little movement has occurred with respect to that that issue. So when they entered when the NDP entered the campaign, they were polling very well. They were launching a number of ads highlighting the shortcomings of the Senate. They were isolating a lot of scandals that had been plaguing the Conservative government. But over time, the issues evolved away from the NDP, and the Conservatives started to own the agenda, started to really control the talking points. They being the Conservatives, were focusing a lot on the economy, a lot on putting money back into hands of taxpayers, very pocketbook, very kitchen table issues. The NDP tried to do a few retail policies as well in the early stages of the campaign, things like affordable daycare. That was a big thing. But over time, a lot of chinks in the NDP armor started to appear, especially since, if I'm not mistaken, the NDP policy for daycare wouldn't really come into effect until about 8 years, until about maybe 2023. So there were a number of policies that once they were announced, sounded great, and a lot of people did say, well, how does that affect me? And those people were getting good vibes, but over time, the NDP really started to lose control of the message. And a real critical point in time in this campaign, I think, was the introduction of refugees and the niqab debate, which has really...
Let's come on to that. Sam, I was going to bring you in and talk about some of the issues that have been prevalent in this campaign. The Najab controversy has been something that's sort of made sort of news coverage over here. I mean, do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about that and what you know, the impact of that on the campaign? Because and maybe talk about that and maybe some of the other issues that are important as this campaign is unfolding. Because it seems to me that the campaign is where it is now is a very different place from where it started.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's quite interesting about particularly the right in Canadian politics is where it differs. In many ways from the UK is and other European right-wing parties, there's been a real move on their part to draw in votes from ethnic communities, from immigrant communities. And so it was quite interesting to see Stephen Harper take a very strong, slightly bizarre stance, but given that this doesn't seem like it was a particularly big issue in the sense this wasn't happening very often, but he took a very strong stance against a woman when during her Canadian citizenship ceremony wearing a niqab, wearing a full veil, the extent to which she should remove that for the ceremony and for the photo. And it just became a very big issue. It became sort of a hot button topic. I think it very much appealed to the base, Harper's base, and I think it really kind of got to the root of certainly the Canadian self-image of a country that's welcoming to immigrants, that is, you know, an immigration center, and draws in a lot of people, and how that sort of fitted, how this approach fitted with the overall national image on that part, but then also the fears that the Conservatives have been playing up for some time around.
So was this an attempt, Sam? Was it sort of a deliberate attempt to sort of solidify his base, seeing his poll average slipping and so on, or was this really just a sort of an events dear boy kind of moment?
No, I think that this is more of one where I do think it was him intentionally stirring something up. I don't think this was something that was particularly huge or particularly pressing. But it's certainly been a topic that he has been trying to play with for some time. This idea that he, you know, he's taking a stance for kind of Canadian ideals that are, more around the liberal with a small L,
sort of secularist thing. Almost.
Yeah,
sort of French secular kind of attitude.
Yeah, and we've seen this play out in a number of different areas. In the country, we've seen it in regional elections. It was a big issue in a recent Quebec election. So I think it's something that's bubbling away there. But I'm not sure personally that it's a huge vote swinger either way. I'm not really sure it was anything other than a kind of desperation move.
Some have attributed the collapse in NDP support to their leader coming out quite stridently defending the woman's right to wear a niqab, though. So perhaps it's not done as much for Harper, but has it done more for the NDP, or is that a false connection to draw?
I don't know what Adrian thinks on this, but my own view is that I think actually what's really seen a bit of a drop in NDP support and a solidification of the Liberal vote is the fact that what's actually happened here is that the traditionally centrist party, the Liberals, has headed left, and the traditionally left-wing party, the NDP, have been caught in this trying to prove their fiscal bona fides situation by promising things like balanced budgets and all the rest of it, and then also still promising big new spending. And I think this sort of inconsistency inherent to that has put a lot of people off, and people have just started seeing Trudeau and the Liberals as being the left, centre-left, real alternative to Harper, and started to coalesce behind that.
I think
ultimately it's coming down to an economic thing more than these sorts of cultural issues, which kind of create a lot of smoke, but then I think blow away. I don't think that's necessarily driving people to particular parties at the polls.
I mean, Rob, one of the things we see in elections, and I know you've worked on election campaigns across the world, often the importance of the leader is understated, in my opinion. What's your take on Harper's personal popularity? And, is there an anybody but Harper vote out there, do you think? And how might that play into tactical voting when we consider that, I suppose, the lazy assumption as an outsider would be that there are two parties of the left to some degree, and then there's the Conservatives, and it's quite easy to split those two parties. So, I mean, what's your take on maybe tactical voting and Harper's position as a Prime Minister?
Yeah, I think there's two things at play there. One is the potential for an anyone but Harper vote. And it's clear, I mean, there was an article, I think, recently about some quite sophisticated moves involving polling in order to help people who wanted to unseat Conservatives to know who, in a sense, was the most viable challenger in their particular riding, which is was for me really interesting, because we've seen sort of vote swapping in the UK before. Billy Bragg was involved in it as long as 10 years ago, in terms of, people in Liberal Democrat sort of challenger seats swapping with people in Labour challenger seats to sort of unseat the Tories. But really quite a sophisticated thing there, which would suggest that there is definitely an anyone but Harper vote. But I think the other thing that's interesting is about momentum. I mean, even without looking at, riding by riding polling, you can see in the national polls this movement. And I think it was last time around you saw a big swing in the final week of the election as the NDP clearly positioned themselves as the challenger, and the Liberals clearly looked set for a bad day at the polls, which got worse over the course of the last week as clearly there is some, I guess, anti-conservative feeling, which then just needs to find the momentum to coalesce around a particular challenger. And my read of it is that if that is just all moving towards the Liberals, then the Liberals could well be at the, you know, the upper end of the sort of estimates that we're seeing now in terms of their ridings.
I mean, Adrian, what about Justin Trudeau? I mean, he's got this rich heritage, I suppose, in Canadian politics. I mean, one would assume if the Liberals were ahead in the polls that, unlike Ed Miliband back in the UK election, you know, Trudeau is seen as a credible prime minister in waiting in Canada. I mean, what's his sort of personal leader ratings in comparison to Harper's?
That's an interesting question. And to answer that, I'd like to highlight a poll that Abacus Data did in February of this year. It's a little stale in the grand scheme of things. I know elections obviously add new information to a voter's paradigm. But Abacus asked about 1,000 people on their online poll, and Abacus does almost exclusively online polling. They asked them 16 questions as to which leader would you pick to do any one of the following. So to negotiate a contract on your behalf, or who would you most like to go on vacation with? And Justin Trudeau, these are more personal traits, so these are, you're getting at the leader themselves. Justin Trudeau was first choice on about 10 of the 16 items, but they weren't really fiscal in nature. Now, that's changed a lot. The Liberal Party playbook has been hammering over and over again, middle class, taxing the 1%, giving more money. I think they're pledging about $2,500 for families that are very much in need. So they're trying to really own the middle class. However, when it comes to the leader, Justin Trudeau did really well on things like, trust to choose a good movie to watch, or more likely to go on vacation with, or cook the best meal. Whereas Stephen Harper was first choice on 5 of the 16 items. Almost all of them were fiscal in scope. 38% of respondents wanted Harper to negotiate a contract on their behalf, or giving advice to their children about the future, or career advice investing your money. So Trudeau has an advantage over Harper in that Trudeau is very likable. He's young, he's youthful, he's got a lot of charisma, a lot of energy. He's got a name brand that goes back to late 60s, early 70s, with the Trudeau Liberals won a majority in 68, a minority in 72. And then two majorities from 74 to 84. And 84 is when Mulroney came into power and the Conservatives took control. But Justin Trudeau he does really well on likability. People like the guy. When it comes to Mulcair in terms of leadership, the NDP invested a lot of political capital, a lot of their resources in around knowledge, around the awareness of their leader. I believe their polling showed that people did like Mulcair. Okay, he came second in a lot of, giving advice to people. Actually, in the poll that Abacus did, Thomas Mulcair was first choice in one of the 16 items, and the one item that he did that respondents did pick him was to lend them $100 if they needed it. About 38% of respondents had that. So, he's not disliked, but I think the NDP problem when they entered the campaign was that we have a leader that people do like, but his awareness is very low. So if you look at a lot of the NDP media and the communication strategies, they incorporate Tom Mulcair a lot into their literature and the ads. A lot of the ads have focused on him coming from a large family, his experience as a Quebec cabinet minister. On the provincial level, he was Minister of the Environment, and his middle-class background. So the NDP tried to put a lot of emphasis on branding their leader and basically making the leader the tip in their spear. But the problem is that when the majority of your focus is built around crafting the leader and the NDP makes some interesting plays. For example, what was mentioned earlier about balanced budgets, but you know, promising a lot in spending. I think people start to see Thomas Mulcair as a bit duplicitous. You know, there's a kind of, who is this guy?
I was saying maybe all things to all people to an extent?
But I think that one of the big problems when you see the NDP numbers starting to slip is that the NDP didn't lock in their core supporters first. And when they kind of signal right and signal left simultaneously, and people are kind of confused, a lot of the NDP base is confused as to which way our party is going to go. I think that a lot of people, a lot of NDP supporters who maybe at the beginning of the campaign were going to vote NDP, are starting to look to the Liberal Party. And just to add, I hope I'm not monopolizing the discussion, but just to add another layer to that, Manos found that a large majority of about 56% of Liberals would vote NDP as their second choice, and about 54% of NDPers would vote the Liberal Party, the LPC, as their second choice. So basically, the problem for the NDP is that you're fighting the Liberals and the NDP are fighting over the same group of voters, which is ABH or ABC, anything but conservative. And when you start to lose that base because people start to see less credibility in you as a leader, especially when a lot of your playbook was built around pumping you as a leader, it's really hurting their numbers. Yeah. And the NACAB issue is really making its mark in Quebec of all places, as was mentioned earlier.
Sorry, go on, Sam.
I think on the leadership front, which I think maybe there's something that's indicative, is when one of the early Tory ad campaigns was very and has carried on through the election. It was a very targeted advert against Trudeau, basically saying the tagline was "just not ready." And what I think Trudeau has been so firstly, it's interesting that the Tories seem to think that his leadership was something they needed to attack and that they could attack, that he was a person they could target far more than Mulcair. And secondly, that approach seems to have not been hugely successful, mainly because he's sort of shown that maybe he is ready, or at least ready enough, and that people are willing to trust him and to support him. So I think that's one that has been interesting to see. When you see what the Tories are targeting, you can maybe see where they feel like there is a weakness, maybe on the Liberal side, but also a vulnerability on their side they needed to shore up. And it doesn't seem to have worked, which has been quite an interesting theme through the election.
I agree with that point. And to further that point, the Conservative playbook since 2008 has been to their, they believe that the Schwerpunkt, the kind of the sweet spot, is to go right after the leader with negative ads right away, and to basically paint the Liberal canvas before they even have a chance to paint their own canvas. They did this with Dion. They ran a number of ads saying "not a leader." They went after Michael Ignatieff, who is an accomplished academic and who did spend a majority of his professional career outside of Canada. But when he became leader of the Liberal Party and just before the 2011 election, the Conservatives just launched quite literally hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars worth of ads going directly at him. And the slogan was "just visiting." And then they tried to do that with Justin right after the day after Justin Trudeau won the party's nomination, the Conservatives launched a series of ads saying "just not ready" being the kind of narrative that they're really trying to paint. They're really trying to put him as just incompetent.
No time for a novice. Rob, what do you think? I mean, let's spend the last sort of 5-10 minutes talking about what we think might happen. And ultimately, I suppose the dynamic is it sounds like Liberals are ahead in the polls if they are to be believed, that there may be a new government of some kind. But then, of course, you know, as in any first-past-the-post electoral system, it's not just about the vote share nationally, it's about the seats. And there was such a huge discussion in Westminster in the UK about that back in May. I mean, Rob, what do you think? I mean, do you think anyone can win a majority? I mean, it looks good for the Liberals, but I mean,
I think it's highly,
once they don't win a majority, it's all bets are off, aren't they?
I mean, I think it's highly, highly unlikely, but in First Past the Post, you know, there are all sorts of weird things that can indeed happen, as we saw with the Conservatives in the UK able to get a majority of seats on less than 40% of the vote, for sure. And of course, that's what the Conservatives were able to do in the Canadian election last time as well. I think the interesting thing will be, as you say, the extent to which the Liberals are able to win seats in Ontario, where I think I'm right in saying something like a third of the seats, a third of the ridings are, which I believe was, you know, one of their historic strongholds that they, you know, it was huge shock at them losing quite so many seats there last time, or certainly over the course of the last sort of, you know, since they're in government, losing so many seats. So I think if they can pick up the seats there, you know, huge concentrations, big urban centres, you know, that's the places where they need to be picking up seats of both the NDP and the Conservatives. And I think the other place is British Columbia, where I think I'm right in saying that they only had two seats last time, but this time the polls look like it might be a sort of a third, a third, a third. So it's all about translating, you know, your popular vote share into seats where it really, really counts, and having your resources committed there accordingly. So I think those big kind of urban and suburban battles in British Columbia and Ontario are going to be really where this election is decided. And you've got a really interesting mix of genuine three-way contests. I believe Vancouver Granville has some really interesting polling that the Conservatives held last time. The NDP were in the lead at the beginning of the summer. Most recently, constituency polling suggests that the Liberals should take it. Kitchener Centre, which is in Ontario, similar kind of story there. And then, you know, there's LibCon fights like Mississauga. I'm going to totally offend people in Waterloo, which is kind of in central Ontario, you know, sort of big, sort of almost the suburbs of Toronto and so on. And then Brampton East, which is currently an NDP-held seat, which I think is the kind of place where if the Liberals are able to take that off the NDP, then they're certainly going to be headed for, you know, for being the largest party.
Let's talk about the Liberals and the NDP, because, I mean, it strikes me that, you know, let's say the Liberals are the largest party, the polls will point to that in some form or another. Maybe they don't get a majority, maybe they do. They're going to have to form some sort of coalition, presumably, or at least some sort of a minority administration. I mean, Sam, what's your take on the prospects for, let's assume that the Liberals became the largest party? I mean, maybe you want to challenge that as a likely outcome, but you know, what do you see the sort of potential mechanisms or the potential sort of situations we might find ourselves in after October the 19th?
I think now the only real shock would be if either the Liberals or the Conservatives weren't the largest party. So the only, like, I think it, there's a chance the Conservatives could have a few more seats than the Liberals and vice versa. What I doubt will happen, I may be wrong, but what I doubt will happen is that we'll have a formal coalition if it's the Liberals and the NDP. I think the experience of the Lib Dems will terrify any third party at this point. Any political leader or leadership worth their salt will have paid attention to what can happen if you really sign up to be the junior partner in an administration you can't actually control. Now, would they set up some kind of formal delineation of things we can agree on? Let's not bring down a Liberal minority government. And just keep plugging away and supporting budgets and, you know, the big votes, and then we can work together on the margins. I think that's a pretty likely outcome. What is extremely unlikely is if the Conservatives were to have the most seats but not a majority, is either of the two left-wing parties supporting them anymore. When Stephen Harper previously had a minority, he was propped up on key votes by Liberal support, because the Liberals didn't want to be seen as bringing down the government. And I think there is no desire on the part of either of the parties to prop Stephen Harper up in government anymore. They will bring him down, and then they will set up an alternative. I don't think we'll go to another election. I think we will have, you know, a left-wing government of some kind. I'd just be very, very surprised if it's a formal coalition.
I mean, Sam, I mean, Adrian, it sounds to me like there's, it's Harper's days are numbered. I mean, do you share that view? Or do you think he's got more of a chance than maybe some people are giving him credit for? Not that Sam's suggesting he's dead and buried, but, you know, it seems like it's not looking good for him.
No, things aren't looking good for the Conservatives. I think it would be pretty ignorant to say stick a fork in them, they're done, because they're not. The Conservative strategy has been centered around, look, identify our support and do whatever we can to get them to the polls. Forget the other seven out of every 10 people that don't like you. The Conservatives know that they're not going to win over a whole new group of voters. So their job is to work with what they have. Their base has been very loyal. This Nanos poll that came out today showed that about 15% of Conservatives would have the Liberals as their second choice, but about 44% or more Conservatives don't have a second choice. They're very stalwart supporters. And the Tory base, I think, is the most likely to come out to the polls. They're made up of older Canadians and more kind of mature Canadians. So I don't think that the Conservatives are down and out. There's still a couple of days left. I think it all comes down to the ground and whether the Conservatives can really motivate their people to come to the polls, because their ground strategy, they don't knock on doors that they haven't identified in the past. They know who took a sign. They know who donated money. They're very data-driven in their campaigns, and I think that they're going to rely very heavily on this kind of this growing and enhancing and dynamic model that they've been working on arguably since 2006, since they formed government. So I don't think that they're done, but the probability of them forming a majority government, very, very, very slim.
I'm going to go to Rob in a minute. Before I do, it just comes to mind. Obviously, the last Parliament and even ongoing has been dominated in Westminster in the UK by the SNP and the rise of Scottish nationalism. Given Quebec's history and the sort of separatism there and the various referendums that were cited during the Scottish independence referendum campaign, I mean, what do we think of the Bloc Québécois? Like, do we think that they're, I mean, obviously they've only got a handful of seats, but is that issue on the back burner, or is that having any sort of impact in this campaign, or is it very much something that, you know, rears its head from time to time and isn't a big deal at the moment? I mean, Sam, what do you think?
I think the you know, it is definitely, you know, remains the defining characteristic of Canadian politics in many ways. But yes, it's on the back burner. So there's both a separatist party that fights elections in Quebec in the provincial elections there. So that's the Parti Québécois, and then you have the Bloc Québécois in the House of Commons in the national parliament. Both have taken a beating recently. The Parti Québécois, the provincial party, were in government and lost pretty dramatically when they were expected to win. So I think yes, it's on the downswing. It seems to be pretty definitive right now that French Canadians are not interested in fighting an independence battle, and it would be a very big shock, I think, if we saw anything other than a handful of seats in the next national parliament sitting with the Bloc, sitting with the independence movement. It's yes, when you look at the span of Canadian political history, it's the biggest issue there is, but not right now, and doesn't seem to be likely to rear its head anytime soon. And you know, I've said that now, so it's probably going to be the biggest. there's no real evidence that that's going to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, Rob, you were going to come in with some thoughts on the.
Well, no, this was on the previous point about, you know, are the Tories dead and buried? I mean, there's a certain nervousness having put my modest wager on the Liberals being the party with the biggest seats. I do sort of get kept awake by the polls looking suspiciously, you know, favourable towards the Liberals, and a certain Crosby being involved in a campaign looking to paint the leader of the opposition as a sort of an out of touch person and all the rest of it. And, you know, I think the points that Adrian made about turnout and knowing who your vote is, without the threat of a UKIP type, you know, as far as I'm aware, a UKIP type threat to their right, it does suggest that, you know, they are going to be effective at getting their vote to the polls. They're not going to win over many swing voters. But I think this decisive movement to the Liberals in the last couple of weeks of the campaign is probably going to be the thing that takes them over the edge. I think if the NDP support had, if that support on the left had remained more fractured, I think the Conservatives would have had more opportunity to come through the middle.
I suppose, as ever with any election, you've always got the chance of a polling nightmare. We can't be arrogant about that, given what happened in the UK. Of course, you know, Canada has a completely different sort of polling infrastructure and different organisations involved, at least publicly.
But it might help decipher some of the things that were going wrong. I mean, even if the Liberals are the largest party, it would be really interesting to see if the Conservative vote has been consistently underpolled in a way that, you know, could mirror the UK situation. And I think the points that Adrian was making about an older electorate that's more likely to turn out but possibly less likely to do polls, particularly, you know, online polls and all the rest of it, you know, there will be certainly useful things that, you know, British pollsters will be able to, and American for that, you know, any pollsters will be able to learn from the relationship between the polls and,
I mean,
and the
Adrian,
votes.
How nervous do you think the pollsters, I mean, the pollsters are always going to be nervous during a general election campaign, I suppose, but I mean, you know, how confident do you think the pollsters are that they have this right? I mean, do you think we could end up seeing another polling disaster in Canada like we did in the UK? What do you think?
Well, it depends on how you frame disaster. And I'll quote Lord Ashcroft on this. I saw a speech that Lord Ashcroft gave shortly after the 2015 election in the UK. And to summarize his point, he was saying not all polls were wrong. Some of the horse race polls may have been incorrect in Canada. That might be the case. I think that we're likely to see more accurate polling today and tomorrow, as opposed to yesterday or the day before, because the opinions are starting to harden and people are starting to make up their minds as to who they want to vote for. That'll harden up until the people walk into the polling station. But with reference to Lord Ashcroft, he was saying, look, I wasn't all that wrong in my polls. I, being Lord Ashcroft, called about, 35 out of the 38 constituency polls he did in Scotland with an average error rate of about 3.3. In England and Wales, he had an average error rate of about 3%. So he was saying, you know, not all polls are incorrect. And I need to kind of make this point now that I have the opportunity. The media in the UK, in the United States, in Canada is absolutely obsessed with horse race polling. And that's fine and dandy. And I think that there's lots that we can learn and observe from horse race polling. And I think that horse race pollings are great over time. Once we look back at some of the aggregators and we see trends over time, I think that horse race polls really illuminate and kind of put a picture to how the campaign has been going. They certainly quantify it. I think that some pollsters may be inaccurate, depending on how they sample, what questions they ask, and how devout they were to the methodology. I think all pollsters in Canada are trying to, quote-unquote, get it right. I don't think that there's anyone out there, doing a 30-Kopeck job when you meet a 50-Kopeck poll. I think everyone is trying to be correct and try and get the most accurate snapshot of what's going on. But, I mean, there's a margin of error in the polling industry, and some pollsters, I believe, will have that, and some pollsters won't. But I think that the media should take a step back and say, maybe we should not invest so much of our narrative, of our words, of our weight into the horse race polls, and that has opened the door to more constituency polling, and of course the horse race coverage has now shifted towards the grassroots level, the constituency riding level, which is okay. That's good. That's adding to the broader discussion. I'm slightly nervous, yes, but I have faith. I have faith that pollsters and market researchers are doing everything in their power to ensure that the data they present is high quality, regardless of whether they use IVR or online or live caller.
I'm gonna finish with that horrible sort of, you know, stick your neck out question. I'll give you guys an option of too close to call then, I suppose. Now, in a first past the post election system, as we know, you know, it's not the same as when Barack Obama runs against you know, Mitt Romney, and we immediately know who the president's going to be, albeit in, you know, when his term carries on in January. Obviously, there's a chance that the Prime Minister in Canada will carry on, try to form some sort of government. It may or may not succeed, and so on, much like in the UK. But in the longer term, let's say like the next permanent prime minister that's going to be there for the longer term, I mean, do you think Harper's going to stay, go, or too close to call? Rob, what do you reckon?
I think my view is that the Conservatives will do better than lots of the polling at the moment might suggest. So I think the Liberals will get, you know, they'll fall short of a majority, but as we've discussed earlier, I think Trudeau's odds on to be the next Prime Minister.
I'm going to give Sam the last word, but Adrian, I mean, very briefly, because we're almost out of time, but what do you think? You know, Harper stays, goes, or too close to call?
I think he's burned the boats on this one, and I think that if he doesn't get what he intended to get, which is government, I think he'll probably, most likely, step down.
And Sam, what do you think? Give the last word to Sam.
I'm going to be a bit of a weasel and say that on a technicality, Stephen Harper will be the next Prime Minister, because he will remain Prime Minister afterwards when there is a clear majority winner.
Like Brown in 2010.
As you were asking, the next long-term, more permanent Prime Minister in Canada will be Justin Trudeau.
Excellent. Well, thanks everyone for joining me. That was the politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. Hopefully something different and interesting for the listeners to get their heads around the upcoming Canadian election, obviously a very important one. I want to give my thanks to Adrian and Sam for joining us from Canada and taking time out of their lunch to be with us today. And obviously Rob, as usual. And thanks everyone for joining us. The music you're about to hear is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed under a Creative Commons. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for some more politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcasts in the near future.